food fans, Alton Brown here. We've got a little special, I think it's a special treat today. We're going to be interviewing, and we're going to spend the entire episode on this one conversation because it's so awesome. This is a gentleman that a lot of you may know from from the internet, from, of course, I guess you can know anybody from the internet, but he's got a lot of followers, like on Twitter and such. But I think actually most of us know him, well, either from his work on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, or of course from all of those lovely Mac commercials back when one guy used to play a Mac and this guy used to play the PCs, which is funny because tell you the truth, John Hodgman is not real PC. Like to me, he's about as un-PC as I could ever hope to find. He and I crossed paths several years ago working on an article for, well, you'll hear us talking about it. It was a barbecue thing. We had a great time and have tried to stay in contact ever since, although it's been tough because he's been busy and became a big star. And I, you know. Well, anyway, John Hodgman is the interview today on the Alton Brown Cast, and I hope you will enjoy.
Okay. Well, that was the most important thing
that
I was going to say.
So actually, John Hodgman and I have just finished our conversation.
It was a doozy.
There's absolutely nothing left to hear. So we're just going to sit and perhaps play cards.
Yeah.
And you'll get to listen to
it. Where's it going to be 40 minutes of room tone? Can we just get some room tone?
You know what? I bet that there's a place for a podcast of room tone. If you have the right rooms, like today we're in St. Peter's.
I'd listen.
And we're just going to have room tone. Okay. Shh.
All right, we got it, everybody.
We got that. People, to 10.
Now look, you are a producer of filmed entertainment.
Yes, I do film things occasionally,
and so you know what room tone is all about.
I do.
I look, when we met, yes, I was but a lowly journalist, sandbagging my way into your life for my article. I don't even know if sandbagging is correct. Sabotaging myself, I guess. Sneaking my way into your life.
Do you remember the magazine?
Of course, Men's Journal magazine. I was a food columnist.
Yes, you were.
And they said, we want you to go on a road trip, and we want you to take along somebody who knows about food and is a famous in that world. And this was in, I think, 2004 or 2003, maybe even.
I don't know.
Well, whatever it is, it was a different.
It's one of those years. It was one of those early 2000 things.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot, and you would have more to say about this than I would, but food culture was on the cusp of something, including what food celebrity was.
Yes.
But setting that aside for a moment, I knew immediately that I wanted to go on a Southern road trip, and I wanted to call you. Because I was such a fan of your show, and I had never really done any driving through the South, and I knew that you lived in Atlanta, So my hope was that you would be game
to
do this. We had a good time, but I frequently look back on just how patient you were. Well, just what an implausible adventure it ended up being, in the sense that I called you up through some PR person or a manager, yeah. some layer.
Somebody who's gone now. A layer.
Sure.
A temporary layer.
A layer who has been retired to the layer.
Yes, the layer. The layer of layers.
And you were very game to go on this road trip, and you had a very specific destination in mind, which was to go to Oxford, Mississippi, a place that has become extremely important to me in my life since then because of that trip and because of subsequent trips. And I was like, yeah, great. This is terrific. And it was not until I showed up at your house in a rented Buick LeSabre.
It was a Buick LeSabre.
Half and half colored, like organic half and half colored Buick LeSabre. And it was not your house. It was your office.
It was my office, yeah.
That I think it certainly struck me as like, oh, I'm getting in a car with a stranger. And I'm getting paid to do this, but strangers not getting paid.
No, not getting paid.
Yeah.
Not getting paid.
And so we had to to drive roads that we had never seen before, and we had never really spoken before.
Nope.
But luckily we bonded.
And we had a good time.
Yeah, I had a great time.
We
One
had
of the most memorable
barbecue.
Trips.
We had some bad. I've thought back often about the fact that remember we kind of had this conversation of good barbecue versus authentic barbecue. Do you remember when we had that conversation?
I do.
Because some of the best barbecue we had was like at a gas station out of like something a quasi commercial like machine.
Yes, you have to understand. I've told this story in amazement.
You?
So many times.
Really? Well, I want to tell it the way you tell it.
Well, all right. So we were driving along through, we went first to, we were in Alabama.
The natural progression from Georgia to Mississippi starts with Alabama.
Yes, that's true. But there's a very, very famous Alabama barbecue place that I'm blanking on
now. Yeah, me too. Doesn't matter.
All right.
It was Dreamland.
It was Dreamland. Okay. And I think it was the Tuscaloosa branch for one reason or another. I think we had to go south.
Yeah.
Right.
I think you're correct.
And it was fine, you know? But it was one of those. I think that we began to form a theory, or maybe this is a theory that you had that I lifted off of you, that like the more barbecue-y, like old-time license plates that are on the wall, and pictures of barbecue and like street signs that are on the wall, the less good the barbecue is. Because then it becomes about the quote unquote barbecue experience.
And selling sauce. Selling bottles of sauce.
Yeah, that's where the money is in barbecue.
Yeah, that's where the money is, I think.
That's like selling liquor in a restaurant, right?
Yeah. And so wine. you want to make sure that they get a bottle of sauce when they go at $7 and it's probably made.
So everything's gotta have this wacky identity to it.
It's branding.
Right. And then we stopped at a place that was, it was literally a guy had a small shack attached to this green chimney.
Yes.
And he was doing Boston butt, as what, you know, pork shoulder.
Yes.
In this chimney. And it was really weird because it was almost like the way you would make a tandoori bread where you slap it up on the side of the oven.
Literally.
Like he had it shoved up on the side of the chimney.
Yep.
So it was really much closer to the heat than was traditional. And it was tough as a result because it was too hot.
It was grilled meat.
Grilled
that had a lot of smoke on it.
Right.
But you remember that there were people that were coming from a couple of counties over because they loved it so much.
Right. And it posed an existential dilemma, which is what is good barbecue?
Exactly.
Because it is a traditionally a poverty food. It is a food that is not trained in the CIA.
They probably have it now.
You probably can major in barbecue at the Culinary Institute of America for sure.
You can.
But at the time, you know, it's a traditional folkways food. Mm-hmm. And so what it is what it is. And for the people, I think you were saying, it's like, who am I to say? Like, for the people around here, this is what barbecue is. Even though scientifically they're doing something that is displeasing.
I would have argued that it wasn't pleasant.
No.
It wasn't that pleasurable for me.
Right.
But I do understand that living in an area like that, where they're probably inundated with drive-through chain restaurants and stuff, to still have something from the past, even if it isn't that good, is unchanged.
It's the ritual of going to that place.
It's the ritual.
And
we're going
knowing,
to go there
and
we're going to get it and we're in the know and this makes us really local and this stuff's great.
Yeah. And that place was legit local.
Legit. Like
that was not...
Yeah.
You know, phony baloney.
No.
Which is the name of my barbecue place.
It was
just fun for love.
That'd be a food truck.
Yeah, exactly.
Funny baloney.
Then we got to Oxford and we got there and we did it. We pushed it all through in one day because I think somewhere in Alabama around the bad barbecue, you wised up and you're like, I don't want to spend a night in Alabama.
Not that there's anything wrong with Alabama, mind you.
No, I could go on and on about how great Alabama has been since I've been back there on comedy tour and stuff. Have you ever been? This is interesting. The Bottle Tree Cafe in Birmingham.
In Birmingham.
It's great.
It's a great
bar
place.
And a great music
venue. The
food's
good.
I haven't eaten there.
They've got some food there.
Do they really?
Yeah. They've got
a...
I mean, it's not a lot, but yeah.
I and the people at the Bottle Tree have one of these flirtations going on where they keep saying, you come back and you perform here. Because I had been down there with the Daily Show at the college. And then we went out there for drinks, and I'm like, I want to perform here. And they're like, we want you to perform here. And about once a month or so, we say that to each other on Twitter, and someday it'll happen.
You just show up.
I guess so. But anyway, yeah, love Alabama. But you were why? You were like, we were in a Buick LeSabre together, strangers. I think we had our appreciation for the album The Night Fly by Donald Fagen in common. But after a while of driving, the conversation, there's only so much you can say. I mean, there's a lot you can say about that album, but...
But we had also taken apart the movie Minority Report.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, we did. I remember it very well.
Minority Report? I don't think it can come out at that point.
I remember having the conversation. How many... I'm sure.
Maybe you were precogging it.
No, I didn't precog it. No.
Maybe a ball, very, maybe a this, little ball we had like very, rolled down no, a track
no,
in your head.
No, we had a very specific conversation because we both agreed that the ultimate flaw with the movie was that because his shooting of that guy was actually an accident, it never would have generated the ball. And we had this conversation. So right. It must have been out by then.
Well, people can go and look at the records.
There they absolutely they can.
We've had other conversations since then.
We have, but not in a car in the middle of the South on a freeway. We haven't.
That's probably true. Well, maybe Minority Report had come out by then.
I think it had. I think it was just out.
So you were smart, and you said, I don't want to spend a night in Alabama. Let's just keep going.
Let's go.
To Oxford, and you called someone who made magic happen and got us a room.
Yeah.
In Oxford for that night, even though we were due to arrive the next night, and even though it was some music festival that was going on at the time. I remember we pulled into town and Los Lobos was playing the square, and
well, it was
like
big,
Bourbon
It was
Street.
The big, what do they call it?
It's the double-decker festival, they call it.
That's what they call it,
yeah,
yes.
Just flashback to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and then, and Los Lobos was playing. They had closed down the street and built a stage, and it was party time.
Right, and we went out, and we had dinner, and then, we went to our respective rooms, and I remember we had a conversation about the slow food movement, which we can put a pin on and come back to in a minute.
Yes.
But, and then we woke up the next day to finally explore Oxford and explore the food culture. Mm-hmm. Of North Central Mississippi, and it was Sunday, and everything was closed.
Everything was closed.
And you specifically wanted was a some kind of musical, some folkways musical instrument. You wanted a cigar box.
The cigar box pool cue banjo one string banjo thing has got a name. That's got a name, but I don't know what it is.
I'll call it cigar box uke.
Uke.
Cigar box
cigar
one string uke.
One string uke. Single string uke. Yes, I did want one.
And that gallery that was selling those things was closed.
It was closed.
And boy, oh boy, folks, Alton Brown was not happy.
I was very disappointed. I really wanted that cigar that box one string uke.
It was something. And then I'm like, what am I going to do? This poor guy. I dragged him away from his family. He travels with knives. I knew that because you gave me a knife at the beginning of the thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was a good sharp knife, and I've owned it ever since. But I'm like, I'm not going to survive this unless I turn up something interesting for
you
this
gotta
guy.
Find some food, something.
And so I said to the guy at the hotel, "Where should we go? Is there any place that'll sell barbecue?" And there were two things that came up, and one was that I think it was the Gulf or the Shell station way out of town.
It was a Gulf station.
It was a Gulf station.
It's a Gulf station.
And then there was. The place just over the line, just over the county line.
Out State Road 12 or whatever
right.
It was.
Omega for the end.
Yes, Omega.
And we went to the gas station first, as I remember, mm-hmm. And it was a gas station.
Yeah.
And they had some steam trays in the corner.
And a smoker. Big stainless steel smoker.
Well, this is the way that I remember it. Okay. And you tell me, Minority Report, how badly I've got it wrong. Because I remember it. This is a good story. This looks good on you.
Okay, good. Yeah. Roll with it then.
So we go into this place, and we say, is this really where we're going to get the barbecue for this story? In the literally in the next to the Jack Lynx display stand up in the Gas and Go or whatever. And we order some ribs, and we each take a bite. And I remember thinking, this is pretty good actually. And you have this look in your eye, and you're like, something's not right here. And you put the, this is probably not true, where you put the rib in your shirt pocket.
I may very well
or
have.
Or over your ear.
I may well have.
And you just walked outside, and I followed you outside, and you walked around the building. It was like Sherlock. It was like you were Benedict Cumberbatching it, because you walked around, and you said, aha, the game is afoot. because as we turned the corner of the building, the pimply-faced dude in the gas-and-go hat or whatever was walking out a big new plate of ribs from a windowless brick shack. And out of that shack was coming smoke.
Yeah.
And you startled the guy. And you're like, let us in. And it's okay, sir. And we walked inside, and there was this big commercial smoker in there.
Inside a building that looked not...
Looked like it contained electrical transformers.
It could have anything in it, yeah. Very, very kind of broken down industrial. But inside was a stainless steel engine of pork destruction.
Yeah. And
big commercial smoke.
And you talk to the guy, and he's like, I'm not sure I should be saying, like, this guy, who makes this barbecue? Because it wasn't the kid. And he gave the name, and I remember it. May I buzz market it on this?
Yeah,
my memory?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Bee's Barbecue, I think.
Was it?
And he had a little card with a bee, like a bumblebee on it. And you're like, does this guy compete? And he's like, yeah, he goes from place to place. And it's like, oh, this is what's going on. This guy is a barbecue competitor who goes from barbecue festival to barbecue festival, raking in, I don't know what they win, beans?
Untold hundreds. I don't actually know.
And you broke it down for me, like this was barbecue that had been honed by competition to a kind of scientific perfection.
And it was good. It was balanced. It was the texture was right.
It did not fall off the bone, but nor did it cling mercilessly to the bone.
It allowed you to have the sensation of resistance to the teeth. It was good barbecue.
It was good barbecue, and it was in way the diametric. I never know if I'm using that word diametric. Let's just say the opposite experience in that it was not. It was a ringer. Do you know what I mean?
It was a ringer. It was a complete ringer.
Yeah,
and therefore completely inauthentic.
In a sense, yes.
We got hustled. He was hustling us. Yeah. We were hustled. It's just like a pool game.
Yeah,
we got hustled by a pro.
Right.
It's like playing chicken with some NASCAR guy or something. I mean,
so that guy had the science in the back.
Yeah.
Like gas station in the front, science in the back. Yeah. That's a barbecue mullet.
That's exactly what it is. All business up front, party in the back. It was a mullet. It was a ringer, and that took away from the overall experience because what we were looking for.
Not for me.
Well, no.
I got to see
good barbecue.
Yeah, I got to see.
Finally,
I got to see a detective in action. World's greatest barbecue detective breaking the case.
I don't know about that, but the point is that we wanted to find authenticity plus
Encyclosmokia Brown.
Encyclosmokia. I want to get that on a business card because I bet nobody has copyrighted that yet.
Yeah. Well, I just did by
saying. Well, you did. You, that's what you're doing on your phone.
Yeah, that's fine. And then we went to that place over the county line, and that place...
Betty Davis!
Now, I liked that place.
Betty Davis was what we were looking for.
Right.
It was a broken down country store.
Yeah.
With, you remember they had like a VW bus that they had like turned into a dumpster. Remember it was sitting over the side. It was like full of trash up to the windows.
I don't think anyone turned it into a dumpster.
It evolved
into a dumpster over
a dumpster.
Time.
Natural selection at work. And there was a gentleman. There were interesting people coming in and out of the store because you could buy beer there on Sunday.
Yes,
it was across the county line.
Yes, you could.
And
for people who don't know, Oxford, Mississippi is a college town. I mean, it's a historic college. It's Ole Miss.
Yeah,
this
Ole
is
Miss.
Where... You know, this is where the riots happened because of integration.
There was some of that there.
Yeah.
It's also where Faulkner's buried.
And it is also the place where my friend John T. Edge has a tenured track position in barbecue.
And basically...
Like in Southern Food.
He
runs the Southern Foodways Alliance or something down there.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And managed to get that turned into an actual tenured position.
It's a pretty good town.
Yeah, it's a fantastic.
But we would sit there and we would watch, and it was one of these places that you could buy beer on a Sunday. So all the sort of affluent, sweet, polished white kids in there, seersucker, were coming from Ole Miss, and then lots of people from less means were coming, and they were getting some barbecue, and it was the barbecue itself was fine.
It's fine,
but it. It was situated in a real place
and
where something authentic was happening.
The smoker itself was a derelict. I mean, if I remember, it was jet black and greasy, and it's what I wanted to see. Yeah. But the best part of the whole thing was that picnic table under the tree.
Yes.
With a little dog.
Yes.
And then I remember that I had a bottle of bourbon.
That's when I stopped remembering.
So we had real people out on a country road.
Yes.
Barbecue that was good, not the best we had, but it came out of something authentic. And it was we had the whole mise en scène, as it were.
Because that's the thing. Barbecue, like, that is a thing that you can scientifically perfect. Right?
Yes.
And
you can.
You know what I mean? And truly, most food is that way. Right? But it is, as you say, mise en scène. It is the entire experience. Greasy terroir of how you experience a thing that becomes the thing that you remember terroir. Forever. That's my.
It's going to be my Zydeco band. I'm going to call it Greasy Terroir.
Whatever I would have come up with would have been worse. So that's good. 2003 or 4, whenever Minority Report came out.
Whenever that year was.
You know, that whole trip. There, I could tell stories about that trip for a long time, but we'll put a pin in all. What was the other thing we put a pin in?
Oh, crap.
Cigar box, ukulele.
Yes. Yes, it was the.
And the Bottle Tree Cafe.
The Bottle Tree Cafe.
Well, we already talked about
that. But, I did eventually get my one-string ukulele device.
We'll save that for later.
Because they opened the place. But
yeah, for Mr.
How many
Alvin
times
Brown.
Have you been back to Oxford since then?
I've been back 2 times since then.
Business or pleasure?
I created business to be there for pleasure. I went back to do book readings there.
Because they've got one of the best bookstores in...
In the nation.
In
never
the
mind.
South.
Never mind yeah. the South. Square Books.
Square Books is amazing.
Terrific. That's one. And they're open on Sunday, so we got to hang out on the porch there as I planned how I was going to recover this suicide mission that I had sent us on. Because Square Books is open on Sundays, just in case you need to know. They are godless, like all good bookstores.
And they make good coffee upstairs.
They do. But now, like when I went on that trip, that was the first time. I mean, obviously, it was the first time I had barbecue in the South. Mm-hmm. After that, I went to Austin to Lockhart to go to the former Kreitz's Market, which is now Smitty's Market.
Smitty's.
And I ate at the Smitty's, and I did a different piece for Men's Journal where I got up with John Fullilove, who is the young big man who took over the former Kreitz's Market and renamed it Smitty's. And got up at 4:30 in the morning and just walked through his day with him as he trimmed the briskets and put them on and fired up the logs and
the whole nine yards.
It was the whole thing. It was one of the most interesting days and the bar none brisket. No brisket will ever compare to it because I went through that experience of being in the place.
Well, it's probably the best in the world anyway. I mean, frankly, even without that experience, it's fantastic stuff.
Smitty specifically or what you get generally in Lockhart?
Oh, what you get generally in Lockhart.
Yeah, right.
Regionally.
Right, because there are rivalries and stuff.
Yes.
I don't mean to
you don't
bring
need
that
to,
on up.
No, we could probably get our own TLC series about the barbecue wars in Lockhart.
Right, real barbecue husbands.
Real barbecue husbands, real barbecue mistresses, just barbecue wars. I mean, there could be blood in the streets. That's not sauce, that's blood. That could be our tagline.
I'm all for it. You generate good ideas for shows. Well, that's obviously true anyway.
And you generate good books about things that don't actually exist.
I don't know if I'm going to talk about that. I'm still talking about barbecue. Don't you understand what's happening in New York City now?
What?
Well, at that time in New York City, there was no barbecue.
No, and there's still. I mean, there's more barbecue now than there was, but you've got to. But you got to build a fire.
Yeah,
that's tough in New York.
But you are now at the epicenter of the artisanal urban barbecue
scene.
Yeah. Well, you're not actually in the epicenter of it. You're
now in Chelsea.
May I reveal where you are?
Yeah, we're in Chelsea, so that's not the epicenter for barbecue.
Yeah.
Where is it? If you were going to drop a pin, as you say, in a map of the boroughs,
I think Williamsburg is ground zero because of Fête Sal. I don't know if you've been out there.
I haven't
but they
yet.
Were the first to bring in the Smitty's Market style of service where you buy by the pound.
Right.
Right.
Now, which Smitty's, is smart.
Well, sure. I mean, it's fantastic because you buy a lot more than you could ever possibly eat.
Well, you take it home and eat it for days.
That's true. And they were doing that kind of Texas style, low sauce, simple rub, brisket and sausage, which was very new here. And they were, but it was all commercial smokers. There's a dude in Williamsburg who has a place called Brisket Town that's supposed to be very good.
Don't know Brisket Town.
There's a place that's opened up in my neighborhood of Park Slope, or sort of on the twilight zone between Park Slope and Gowanus, called Fletcher's Barbecue, that I like very much. But it's all over the place now.
So you're
ringers. Well, because I'm chasing that dragon, you know, that road trip dragon, you know. But it's hard to get, because every time you go into one of these places, you're by definition not situated in an authentic barbecue space, because it's
Williamsburg.
Yeah, Fetzhau, I think, is the one that I still, and I love Fletcher's, and I go there all the time. They really know what they're doing. Fetzhau just didn't even pretend to be a barbecue place. They're like, we're serving meat in this style. Do you know what I mean?
Got it.
And they gave it a German name just to really push away to some degree.
Well, that's probably smart.
But now it's like it's one of those things where you know, it's like everyone has figured out, if you call something barbecue and then suddenly a droves of foodies will descend on the place, regardless of how good or bad it is.
That's a shame.
I guess so. I mean, it's closer to good than it ever has been, but it's just become very trendy. Well, have you been to Franklin Barbecue in Austin?
I have been to Franklin.
And
I like Franklin.
I like it too.
I do like Franklin. But I like Austin so much that I like almost anything in Austin.
Well, of course. But I mean, I think that guy's a ringer. You know what I mean? He's figured out scientifically, this is how you do it.
He knows how to beat the system, so to speak. It's
yeah. And once you figure it's not, there are a lot of people who want to put a lot of marketing people who want to put a lot of magic around barbecue. Do you know what I mean?
Instead of patience and know-how?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really...
You know, it's temperature, indirect heat, time. You figure out a system. You follow that system. You either figure that out over years, if not generations, of practice in a traditional barbecue pit, or you figure it out because you graduated from the CIA and you want to start a restaurant, and you just experiment until you get it right, and then you get it right, and you keep doing that,
and
you exercise strict quality control, and you make sure your staff knows what is good barbecue, what is bad barbecue. Because even the best, as John Fullilove told me, even the best pit, the best conditions, one piece of meat can just go wrong for no reason, and if you don't, you know, it'll just toughen up, and if you serve
sense.
It, it'll destroy your reputation.
Yeah. So you have to catch it.
Right. But he's a scientist. That guy's a young guy who's a scientist who went in there, and he's created a great restaurant. But it's centered. It's an urban barbecue place. I mean, it's you know, Austin is the Williamsburg of Texas. So.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The whole town.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go on a whole rant. No, I'm not even know what I'm saying. Some things are good, some things are bad, I guess is what I'm saying. But
well, what you're saying is that as an American art form, barbecue has evolved.
Yes.
We were talking about a trip that we took before that happened,
yes,
where we were trying to balance the equation of authenticity versus quality through whatever means.
Right.
Because what we were trying to find was an overall experience. And now there's an explosion of the form and a even more loss of authenticity. But does it matter?
Well, I think maybe it's an evolution of a new kind of authenticity.
New kind of authenticity.
You know. Because none of the places that I think are doing things right, whether it's Franklin, Fletcher's, Fetzhau, I haven't been to Brisket Town. I got to remedy that. You know, they're not putting license plates on the wall.
Nope.
They're just saying, I'm making barbecue here.
Yep.
And if you can be honest about that, then it's honest. Then it's honest food.
Then that's authentic food.
Then that's what it is. It's Brooklyn style.
Yeah. There's still a lot of room for a lot of barbecue. And a lot of different kinds of barbecue. I, a few years after our trip, made a travel show called Feasting on Asphalt. It was a motorcycle tour.
I'm familiar with it.
And had barbecue mutton, which is a specialty of
Kentucky thing, right?
Small little piece of Kentucky.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's not a big chunk of it. They do this in this one area. And once you've had that, wow. real eye-opener. I mean, I won't say it's the best barbecue I ever had, because that's a scary thing, and I hope I never say it. I ever had.
Look, we're not BuzzFeed. Do you know what I mean?
We're not BuzzFeed.
we can have different bests in our lives.
We can have different bests.
We don't have to rank everything.
It was exemplary.
Yeah.
And their smokehouse is homemade, and they go in there and they lay out those sheep, and they do them in whole halves.
So what part are you eating of the sheep?
I have had the ham, rear quarter, the shoulder, and ribs.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it all.
You had it all.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, a little thyme and a little smoke does wonders for a sheep.
So I know what appeals to me about barbecue is that it's... Is there cursing on this?
You can curse.
It's so gosh darn delicious. Now I don't want to curse, now that I know it's allowed.
Now that you can do it.
But I mean, and it's alchemical, and that you don't know how it happens. And it's so different from anything that you can make at home unless you really know what you're doing. And so there is, no matter where you're going, if you're getting good barbecue, there is that Walter Benjamin aura of the authentic to it, because you have to go to the place.
Yeah.
And you have to make that pilgrimage to the place where it comes off the thing that makes the thing.
And there's also a MacGyver essence of barbecue.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. What draws people who make barbecue to making barbecue?
I think that there are some people that want to play the circuit. They want to do the competition circuit.
Right.
Because it is the NASCAR of food. There are people who want the big hospitality that comes with, I'm taking, I smoked a hog.
Right.
There are people that really enjoy and I'm certainly in this class of like, look, I got to set aside 14 hours for this.
Mm-hmm.
Bring your lawn chair.
Right.
We're going to be up all night.
Right.
Tending the fire. Now, in my own barbecue life, I now specialize.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to whole hog only. My specialty. And I've invented a rig that allows me to single-handedly tend and turn whole hogs. And I've got pictures on my phone. I'll be happy to show you.
Yes, please.
It's an ingenious device that's made for about $70 worth of lumber and cinder blocks. But I've gone to whole hogs because, why? Because I can't quite get it right.
Right.
I'm chasing it.
You're chasing.
I get real close sometimes.
That's what
and
it is.
This end over this end, and there's the whole heat of you must, when you want to be even an amateur pit guy, you want to be able to wrestle time, temperature, and smoke. Ultimately, these are the things. And above all, time and temperature.
Right.
Time and temperature. And so, and those are very hard things to control, really. Temperature over a large amount of time with natural product, with a log.
Right.
And I got to where I was making my own charcoal. I had one fire over here to burn down the logs, and then moving them over here, you can go crazy.
Yeah.
I was even trying to build tunnels underground to cool the smoke to a particular temperature. I went cray-cray for a while.
Yes.
And I was out. It was bad. I was having to throw away clothes because you couldn't get the smoke out of them. And I still would love to pursue that more. But I think that's the obsession. The obsession is with trying to find perfection. And what is that? Well, for me, it's a perfect balance of texture and flavor without the use of a sauce.
Right.
And, like you said, it's delicious. There is no better meat product to me on earth.
Right.
Than good barbecue.
Right.
And nothing.
Something about it, something makes it even better in that you know that it is the product of tons of variables.
It's,
including the difference between the animal from one animal to another.
Where did the pig come from?
Right.
What did the I'm getting my pigs now from a place where they wander in the woods and they're eating acorns and digging for roots.
Sure.
Makes a huge difference. However, I wouldn't have known that it made a huge difference unless I'd done dozens of others first.
Right.
Whether everybody can taste that, I don't know. I don't know if everybody can taste it. I can taste it.
It is both as eater and maker, I think it is it becomes an addictive chasing of perfection.
It's edible jazz.
Whoa.
To me. It's edible jazz, because jazz is based on, you must understand form, you must understand structure, and then you have to be able to let it go.
Right.
And that's barbecue, in a
and
way.
It, see, and to me, that's the thing. It's like you pointed out, it's like to have it be good without sauce. I mean, once you get those wacky sauces with all those different flavors, then you're covering up for
you're covering
for
up something. I mop my whole hogs with a water vinegar pepper mixture. Mm-hmm. And I thought when I first started it that mopping was. Do you want more of that lovely beverage?
I'll have a little more right. Seltzer water.
Well, there's more of it. You go get everyone.
I know that once you get started on the mopping, I
can. No,
35
I'm
minutes.
Go, I'm not going to be gone.
I'm just going to take a quick run around the block.
I thought that mopping was all about flavor, and that you were basically basting the meat. That is a secondary or even tertiary function. It's about temperature control.
I'm just going to use my hand.
Yeah, I wish you would, because there's nothing else over there. It's temperature control. You're cooling down the meat.
What's the vinegar do? Is that flavor?
That's flavor. But you know what? You could mop in water and it would still work.
Right.
But the acidity will cut against the fattiness, because what happens, of course, is as the hog cooks, some of that seeps down mm-hmm. in between the skin and the meat. And, of course, mm-hmm. that pepper is there, so it gives some bite. But I don't do anything else. If you can tear that off, and in most, you dip it back in the mop. But if I see that people are reaching to dip it in something, I have screwed up.
Yeah.
I have not done that animal justice.
Yeah. There you go.
And there is some of that, too. Let's not forget that there is a sacrificial aspect to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I build what is essentially an altar
or
a funeral pyre that I am now going to offer up this whole animal on. It's biblical in proportion. It is the sacrifice. No, I don't kill the pig. I don't really want to kill a pig. And I'm glad somebody else will do that for me. But there's this whole animal.
Yeah.
And we're going to... You know, and my smoker is actually made to where you lift the pig off on its cooking grate, it goes directly onto a table and you eat it there still on its grate. So there's something communally sacrificial about that, because we're all taking, we're all just walking up, and I don't allow utensils.
Right.
It's these three fingers, well, two fingers and a thumb, and
right.
you pull and you eat.
Right.
All there together.
Communal.
And it's messy.
Yeah.
It's messy.
But that's as primal as it gets.
From both a cooking standpoint and a consumption, societal standpoint.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something to be said for that.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
I mean,
you don't see booths. You don't need a booth in a barbecue joint, do you? You don't see many booths in the restaurants, barbecue restaurants.
Well, you need to have some Leon Redbud music on the stereo, right?
Music's important.
That's
true. You got to have the right music going.
Oh, so then that's what happened. We went to Taylor Grocery.
Yes. We did go to Taylor Grocery for catfish,
which is a famous, again, another former grocery store that transformed into, sort of over time, into a restaurant famous for one thing.
Catfish.
Fried catfish.
I can't even think of anything else that's there. I'm sure there's other stuff.
There was a nice band of young people playing music in the corner.
I meant food-wise. I don't remember anything but catfish.
Yeah, no,
just
catfish. I don't remember
what.
Big
piles of fried catfish.
And we went there, and that's where we ran into the young woman who was the manager of the gallery.
That's right.
And she said,
I've forgotten that.
Yeah. I went out. It was just one of these nights of crazy. The whole thing was these crazy coincidences where we thought all was lost, and then all of a sudden,
which happens in the South
all the
time.
Found.
This is very Southern.
I think that it is, and I don't know whether it's, you know, whether you can scientifically account for it because of population and proximity and where people go. I mean, you're the one who pointed out,
Maybe. Oh,
it's Sunday night, everyone's here, because it's truly like everyone in town was there at Taylor Grocery, either in there or waiting to get in outside. And you said, this is the Studio 54 of the South, which is my favorite lines of all time.
It's true. It was, man. It was the scene. If we could have an Andy Warhol in the South, which may be John T. Edge, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't quite fit. But if we had it, he'd been there.
But I remember walking outside, and this will also date it, too, because the Honda Element, car had just come out.
Brand new.
And these shining young people.
Very shiny.
Drove up in their Honda Element. And I had, when you take someone from Massachusetts like me and you put them in the South, there's this period where the meat seizes up. And I was like, what's going on? Why is everyone so friendly? Why are you talking to me like this? And then eventually, once the mop gets on, there's water, vinegar, maybe some bourbon.
Some pepper. You can put some bourbon in there.
In the mop of the Hodgman mop.
You're okay. Yeah, bourbon would
look,
be important.
I want everyone to understand that I conducted myself as a driver perfectly safely in the American South.
You did. But, a little slow.
Well, you got to be careful. It's dark.
You were very careful.
And I had some water dripping over there. It's probably my fault.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
It's the Maritime.
It's a rental.
Hotel. Yeah, right. I had had a drink, and I was walking outside, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, this Honda Element pulls right in front, and it's like all of a sudden all of my meat relaxed. I'm like, I can talk to anyone about anything, and I just said, "Look at that, a Honda Element. How do you like that car?" Which is not something I would ever say to anyone in the world, except after a long day in Oxford, Mississippi. And the young couple in there turned to me, they said, "We love it. Get in." I'm like, okay. So I got in, and they just started saying, "Yeah, this is great." I don't want to buzz market for the Honda Element, but their big selling point, I remember, was you could open up the doors, and the ground was rubber, and you could hose it out.
You could hose out that thing.
I said, "You two are great. What do you do?" And he said something about whatever. I never listen to what the boy says. And the girl says, "I manage the folk art gallery up on the square in Oxford." And I said, "Good, because Alton Brown is in there, and he wants a cigar box ukulele." And she said, "Let's go get one."
Let's go get one.
And I pulled you out the way I remember it.
No, that's how you're.
Because I pulled you out of the restaurant. I said, "Go with these nice people. I'll follow you in the Le Sabre."
Which I was growing fond of by this time, the Le Sabre. Do you remember the book you gave me at Square Books?
You gave it to me.
That's right. I did give it to you.
And that was another one of the things. It was The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break by Stephen Sherrill.
At University of Pennsylvania. I adore that book.
I do, too.
It is... I want to say it's not my favorite book of all time, but it's... I reread that book every year, and I always find it moving and spectacular.
He's an astonishing writer. It's an amazing book. And do you remember...
I found the copy. Got him sitting. It's got the Minotaur sitting. It's the trade paperback version.
And tell the people what it's about. It's about a Minotaur who works at a...
Well, you know, the Minotaur. Anybody that's read their mythology knows the Minotaur. Yes. Well, of course, the Minotaur is immortal, pretty much.
Right.
And now he's working as a cook in a steakhouse in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And living in a trailer park.
Yeah. Just trying to get along.
Just getting by.
Yeah.
Because life as a Minotaur is not... Hard. I mean, sure, it sounds glamorous... And sexy.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of problems.
If you're a Minotaur, you could be out in an open field. But in modern day America, you're still in a labyrinth
of
your mind.
Yep, you're still in the... Oh, nice.
You sign that thing to me. This is how weird Oxford is. You sign that thing to me as a very gracious gesture and handed it to me and said, "Here's a book I think you might be interested in." And I said, I almost represented this guy because I had been a literary agent.
Right.
And that guy had sent that book to me in manuscript.
And I had no idea.
No. And I wrote to him. I said, "I think this is great. I'm quitting this business to go write about barbecue do other things with my life." But my colleague at Writer's House, Simon Lipscar, ended up representing him.
Representing him.
So it was a lot
of
weird...
For those of you that haven't read it, which is probably most of you.
Now you can.
Yeah. So we're absolutely promoting... The Minotaur takes a cigar break. I actually wanted to make that into a movie.
Sure, why not?
I wanted badly to make that into a film.
And I
chased the rights for a while. It was an elusive chase. And I had Stephen Sherrill's contact information and lost it. So I can't even get hold of him anymore.
I can put you back in touch with him if you wish.
I think that would make a great movie.
You're a guy. I don't get it. You're doing podcasts, doing TV shows. You're barbecuing whole hogs in your home for stretches of hours at a time.
Outside the home. It's actually outside.
Yeah.
You have to do it outside.
You don't have a separate barbecue home?
You don't do it inside. It really smokes up the house.
I don't get... And you want to make movies. You're coming up with ideas for shows right and left in this very podcast. I don't have this kind of energy that you have.
What are you kidding? You've done all this stuff. You've made movies. You've been in movies.
Yeah, I've never made a movie.
But
you make things.
You've been in them.
I get dragged along into things.
You just happen to be in the right place at the right time to be drug along. Got drug under the Daily Show. They just drug you on.
Yes, they did.
You got drug into a line of what was probably very profitable Apple computer commercials.
Did you think it was my idea? Do you think I called up Steve Jobs? Here's an idea for an ad.
Your fingerprints were on
it. Steve Jobs, you and I have been dancing around this for a long time. We want to work together. How about a series of ads starring me? Not my idea. I got to give credit. That one line, I do this all the time out in Brown. I'm so sorry. There's a comedian named Paul F. Tompkins, whom you should meet.
I don't know that.
If you don't know him,
I don't.
Please check him out. Paul F. Tompkins. He was Francis.
Okay.
He was an inspiration to me before he was a friend. Now he's a friend. But he is such an inspiration to me that I'm constantly stealing his lines. His saying, we've been dancing around this for a long time, that's a Paul F. Tompkins line from his podcast.
Well, you played it well.
I know. But I just got to give credit.
You came
credit
clean. You came clean.
He had a mustache before I did, too. So I got to say that.
But now, are you going to go with the beard? Are you going to go all out?
Yeah. What you can't hear on the podcast is that I've come back from...
You could rub it on the mic, and then they would
hear
it.
That's true.
There you go. Yeah, that's registering.
Good.
How long is that? How many days did that kind of take you there?
Shit. Well, I could tell you exactly. Hang on one second.
Are you one of those guys who can pump out a beard in 4 days?
No, you notice I can't pump out a beard at all. I've got weird empty seas of skin and patches
but it's symmetrical.
And it's work. It's this is as far as it's ever come. I've been hiding out for most of the summer with my human family up in New England, different parts of New England.
Do you have a family besides human family? You have a non-human family?
We don't talk about them. My Minotaur family?
Your Minotaur family? Or maybe you want to talk about your video game. What is it? One night? What is it?
Two. So this is two. The mustache I've had for a couple of years now, and this substache also a couple of years.
You've had the stash for a while.
Yeah, but the
stash when I met you.
The rest of the garbage is it's interesting. I didn't that I can tell you for sure. But the reason I grew the mustache was that most people thought I was growing a mustache at all times, even when I was shaving that morning, because my skin is so pale and my mustache
is so
pitch dark. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thought you were growing one.
No, well, I'm sure you. I'm sure it looked like I did. But I shaved to do one day of work in a movie on August 22nd.
What was the movie?
It's called Learning to Drive. It's an independent movie, and my scene was with the great actress Patricia Clarkson.
Oh, wow.
And an actor that you may have heard of called Ben Kingsley.
Let me think for a second. Yeah.
And they said, would you be willing...
Bald guy, kind of...
Look, they said... I don't get a lot of offers for movies these days.
I don't get any.
Well, we're going to change all of that. But they said, will you come, would you drive back from Massachusetts? Not a lot of money because it's an independent movie, but you'd just be playing a car salesman. But it's with Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley. And I said, I'm already on the phone.
In the car.
Yeah, I'm in the car.
Yeah, I'm already in the car. How was Ben Kingsley to hang out with?
He was not a hanger-outer, but not in a way that was... off in any way. He was very gracious. He said hello, introduced himself. But then, this is what acting is, like control.
Let's get to work.
He was not chatty between takes. He was kind of just focused and quiet between takes. And then, and the other thing is everyone wants to talk to Ben Kingsley.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like if you're a legendary talent of that kind and you're sitting there and you open the door to chit-chat with anybody else, that
never
door
stops.
Will never close, and then you'll never get your
it's
work
open
done.
Forever.
And particularly now that I understand a little bit, what I do is I sneak my way into worlds. That's sort of one of my... I snuck my way into your life for that weekend. I snuck onto the Daily Show. I earn my keep. I do my job when I get in there. Do you know what I mean?
But
one of the things that brought me to be a writer, to be a journalist, was that I want to see worlds. Do you know?
Yeah.
And acting is a world in which I always wanted to be a part of, but it took me a while to understand you can't sneak into this. If you're doing it, you can't be watching. You have to be in
doing it.
You have to be in it completely. The whole point of acting is to not be behind your eyes, but at the level of your eyes.
You got to be right up front.
And that was a huge thing for me to understand. And so I appreciate and very gratefully how little Ben Kingsley was giving me between takes, because that guy's got to conserve his energy. Do you know what I mean? And he was just, he was amazing. And the thing about Ben Kingsley was, I would get worried, like, am I pissing Ben Kingsley off because he's not talking to me, he's not looking at me in between takes or whatever. And then in a moment, he made a choice where he kind of looks conspiratorially to me as in character, mm-hmm. as a guy who is helping Patricia Clarkson buy a car. And I'm the one selling the car. And he kind of looks to me and smiles. And he's like, and I'm like, Ben Kingsley loves me. Just, yeah. I'm like, oh, he's doing it. That acting.
Oh,
it's acting.
You. It's acting.
But anyway.
Hey, are you getting rich off of
Oh, you monster. Did you?
Is that working for you? Because I want to go ahead and say it's okay to promote it here. Like, I'm serving no master here. I mean, I do follow you on Twitter. please tell this story. Please. And then I'll let you go. But this is funny.
I don't ever want to go. But all right. So I was hiding out in Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
My home state. My home Commonwealth, excuse me. And my wife and family and I have a home out there that belonged to my mom in the Pioneer Valley, where they're getting some good barbecue now, too. In fact, Cliff's Barbecue on Route 5.
Cliff's.
Yeah. That guy is sitting outside with his smoker.
Got it.
And I think he's a competition guy who brings it around to places. But he was parked on Route 5 between between Sunderland and Deerfield, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Anyway,
I know
that's
that
my, that's a
basic
plug.
Region.
Right.
Got it.
And my good friend and collaborator, Jonathan Colton, and his family came up, and I have a son who's 8, he has a son who's 4, and they like to play games on the iPad. And there's this game that hit really big that weekend called though I hesitate to mention the name because they've gotten enough off of me. It's a running game.
Yeah.
You like your Temple Runs, like your Subway Surfers.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a running game.
It's a running game. And I'm out in the world. They're all at home, or I don't remember what I was doing. I went down into the town to get some supplies or whatever, and I check my Twitter feed, and everyone's writing back to me going, I'm glad you're enjoying this game. I got to check this game out. I'm like, what are you talking about? I haven't sent a tweet for hours. And I look at my tweet stream, and it's like 15 tweets from my account saying, I can't believe how much I'm enjoying. And all these really bad jokes about, like, how this suit of armor is really heavy. Because you play a knight. This suit of armor is really heavy. And I
saw these, by the way.
You were probably confused as to why
I was... No, I thought you were pulling some kind of weird...
Metagame.
Joke. A weird metagame kind of thing. It was, yeah. You were Orson Welles-ing us or something. It was not, because it was you, but it wasn't.
It was not.
And there were a lot of them.
Me, and there were a lot of them. And I thought that my account had been hacked.
Mm.
But then I was like, why would it be so specifically hacked to this game that I know a child is playing in my house right now? Oh my God, I got to get home. And I got home, and I grabbed the game. I won't name which of the two
human
children, mine or Jonathan Colton's. But let's just say mine wasn't in the room.
Got it.
But I took the game, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, what happens if I play this game? How is this happening? And then I realized that after your dies in the game, you get the screen that says, do you want to play again?
Mm-hmm.
And if you hesitate for even a moment for pressing play again, these three little animated bugs crawl up the screen. And one of them has an F for Facebook on it. One of them has a T for Twitter on it. I can't remember what the third one had. Some weird South Korean social network that I've never heard of. And I'm like, oh, I want to touch one of these bugs. They got me.
Yeah.
And I press the T bug, and it squashes. And then the game generates a tweet to come from my account, which was logged in already.
Sure, because it was your...
Because it was my iPad.
iPad.
And one of these human children, I'm not going to say which, but it wasn't mine. Very cute young man. Did what any normal human child would
squash do. Squashed the bug.
He squashed the bug, saw the thing, hit send. And every time he finished the game, let's face it, he played a lot of games because he wasn't very good at it. He was just hitting that bug and hitting send and hitting the bug and hitting send and hitting the bug and send.
And every time.
It was devious. They took over my tweet stream. And I can't say I'm happy about, like, no big deal.
But you can't complain, really, because it was on your iPad and it was...
Yeah, but I mean...
You did have a choice to not send the tweet.
But right, but, you know...
A four-year-old wouldn't necessarily put that together.
Everyone did what they should have done in those circumstances. The four-year-old pressed the shiny thing over and over again.
Because
that's what a four-year-old should do.
Yes.
And a savvy game marketer, a savvy game developer, figure out a way, if you are logged into Twitter or Facebook, to make it exceedingly easy to trick a four-year-old into pressing send over and over and over again, because it's a game for kids. Like, there's no, and basically hijack tweet streams and Facebook feeds to spread the word. Now, there was the option to cancel. No harm, no foul. They're doing everything that they need to do to get their running game running out there in the world. But caveat emptor.
Yeah. I thought it was hilarious.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did.
I mean, it's like, you know, I...
And then I figured that your account had been hacked. I even thought
about it. But it was not hacked by...
But it wasn't hacked.
It was not hacked by a malicious...
It was
you know, like a 19-year-old Chinese gold miner in Beijing.
No, it was just hijacked
by a 4-year-old that I knew
in your house
in
with
my
your
own
iPad.
Home. The hacking was coming from inside the house.
It's inside the house.
But I mean, truly caveat emptor, because if is one of gazillion applications of not just games but any kind. That are going to take advantage of automatic logged in social media. Like, so,
of course, one of the lessons here is you probably shouldn't let other people's 4-year-olds play with your iPad.
Well, there's that.
There's that. Well, why would I bring up something so small?
Do you have protocols? Do you use social media or Twitter?
I use Twitter. I have
the thing
Facebook,
I love about your Twitter account is the way you respond to people by writing it down on a post-it.
Yes, post-it.
And putting it up on the screen and taking a picture. Now, are you doing that because that's a funny idea, which it is, or is there another theory behind
it? I started tweeting that way because I didn't like the system. I didn't like, what if I don't want 140 characters? What if I want 150 characters? Or what if I want to draw a picture?
Right.
And then I discovered that an iPhone, you can take a picture and send it directly to Twitter without being on Twitter. So most of the time, I mean, I don't even have the software on my phone, but I can tweet.
Right.
So I started playing around with this concept of an analog tweet and drawing pictures and putting them on the screen.
This is it, folks. Alton Brown hacking left and right. Changing the system, breaking the code.
Well, it just seemed like, and then it just seemed fun.
Right.
Because it wasn't, the idea of social media, I was like, I don't want to do this. And my agent made me, basically.
Oh,
he said, you got a choice. Twitter, Facebook, you're going to have to do one of them. And I have a Facebook page, but it's run by somebody who works for me.
Yeah.
I generate it all, but I don't put it there because I don't understand how it works.
Yeah, yeah.
Twitter is easy.
Yeah.
It's like falling off a log. And every now and then something cool will happen on it. I spent a couple of hours tweeting back and forth with William Shatner.
Ah,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
You know, when something like that happens, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, and reading your chain, which is legendary now.
I'm really mad. Like, I'm almost asking you to go back and bleep out every mention of the brand. Because I'm not getting any.
Do you want me to? I'm more happy to. Maybe that'd be funny.
I think that would be funny.
We'll go back and take out. If you're hearing this and you're hearing all those bleeps, it's not cussing. It's removing the words beep from the... because
it's not a terrible game. It's just, don't make me part of your ad strategy, dude. Like,
you should bill them.
That may be my last way to make money.
How many followers do you have now?
In the 900,000.
You're close to a million.
Yeah.
So that was like 50 tweets, probably.
Right.
What, 30 to...
I don't know.
It was like 30 to 50 tweets to almost a million people on your behalf, on behalf of a...
Jonathan Colton's son is getting a check from them.
I would check because that's...
Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe that's what you do. That's what you do.
It's like an Amazon affiliate program.
Yeah, you send out child agents to play games
on people's devices.
On people's devices where you know they have high. Yeah, don't let a child near your iPad.
Chris, why did you have on your iPad?
My son plays it.
You let your son put games on your iPad?
He doesn't have his own iPad.
Oh, well, then there's no choice.
Yeah, I want to see what he's doing. I don't want him to have his own iPad.
I didn't think about that. I have a 13-year-old daughter with her own iPad, and I didn't think
Well, that's different. My son is 8.
Yeah, that's true.
My daughter is 11, and she just inherited my old phone.
Well, we have to have children now because guys like us don't get new technology unless we have somebody to pass the old stuff on to. In my house, we call it legacy.
Legacy?
Legacy electronics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like my daughter Zoe has a legacy iPad herself, and they're more valuable because there's so many rich memories.
Oh, it's like barbecue. It's like it carries the flavor.
It
carries the aura of where it came from.
Yeah. Legacy Electronics. That's the way we're playing. You probably get all that stuff for free, though. Don't you still get all that stuff for free?
There's
probably a secret number you can call in Cupertino. Somebody picks up the phone, and the next day a new MacBook Pro shows up.
They were always incredibly gracious to me and generous when the ads were running.
Got it.
And then when the ads stopped running, it was always like. It's not like just stuff arrived. I mean, the one thing that I remember arriving without my prompting, and much to my surprise, was the first iPhone, which was the most incredible thing to get in the mail of all time. I mean, it was, and you know, I think we all knew it the minute we held it. It's like, well, this is the future.
That's it.
Like, we're all going to be walking around like this from now on, and it's true. I mean, it really, books will be written and about how culture flipped at that moment,
and you knew it when you got the when you first held it.
Yeah, you knew it. You felt it. You felt it. I could feel it attaching to my brain in a very pleasurable way.
Yeah,
and of course, what it did was it put the internet, which had been until 2007 still a relatively esoteric niche world of relatively affluent gearheads and nerds.
Yep.
You know, and publishing and media types.
Yep.
It put it in the hand of everyone who was going to have a phone. And that means it expanded the demographics of who's using the internet dramatically.
And now I have to program myself to turn it off and put it away.
Yeah.
And I've gone back to carrying a lot of days an old 10-year-old flip phone that I had reactivated that does nothing but take calls and dial numbers. No text, no nothing.
Right.
Just to say, okay, I've got a phone on me, but I don't have it.
You can't, right, because you won't be distracted.
I got to put that thing down.
And it increases the – I mean, this is the thing. It you know, our lives become increasingly permeable to the outside world.
Yep.
Which – you know, I'm not so concerned about me leaking out to the outside world, like people seeing my private life. That's okay. That's fine. People, or even like this inadvertent tweet stream for that's okay. It's not a big deal. Do you know what I mean?
Fine.
But it does allow everyone else in the world in to my attention span in a way that. Like, suddenly I feel an obligation to people I've never met before to respond and everything else. And
well, because they expect you to.
Sometimes, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but it builds a Twitch expectation in me that is uncomfortable and unpleasant, so.
You know how to turn it off.
Yeah, no, that didn't come in the, I don't.
There is no off switch.
Yeah, but that was sent to me, and that was amazing. And after that, if I asked nicely, they would be very accommodating if they could be.
Good partner.
But then after the ads stopped running, I kind of stopped asking because it just felt
inappropriate.
Gross.
It would be weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crossing the line.
They changed they and The Daily Show, among a few others like Dave Eggers and Alton Brown and Ben Carlin, The Daily Show, and John, obviously. These are people who completely changed my life, the trajectory of my life forever in a completely positive direction, creatively, personally, and financially as well. So I'm not going to begrudge them a new phone from time to time.
No, absolutely not. So what are you working on now, short form?
Well,
What's next?
I am doing the Judge John Hodgman podcast, which
is fun.
Brightened a number of times by expert witness Alton Brown.
I've enjoyed it.
I enjoy making it a lot with my friend Jesse Thorne, and I think we're going to try to figure out how we can bring that to other platforms.
As you should.
My natural thought is to do it as a live tour because it's fun, and I've been doing a lot of live performance. You know, since I started doing the book tours, which kind of morphed into an imitation of stand up, and then. Like Arthur C. Clarke says, eventually, sufficiently sophisticated imitation of stand-up becomes indistinguishable from stand-up. And so I'm going around doing stand-up, which has been incredibly challenging. I'd love to do more acting. We'll see what happens there. And then I've got a secret project that I'm working on with Jonathan Colton, which is pure fun.
Nothing wrong with fun.
Yeah. That's there's everything right with fun.
And now that you're tied with Ben Kingsley, world's your oyster.
Well, I'm hoping he's going to be a big part of my career from now on.
Can you get him on the podcast here for me?
I don't know what he would. I don't know what he would say.
I don't think that I would go after Ben Kingsley.
Who would be your dream guest?
I don't. You know what's funny? I don't. People ask me that all the time. I don't have anybody. Mostly, I like it to be people that I know.
Sure,
but I'm going to run out of people.
That's more fun. Yeah, well, that's the thing.
It'll be like. My mom and stuff, and that won't be fun.
I think that'll be a lot of fun. Ooh, I mean, it'll be probably fun for everyone but you.
And her.
In the world of acting.
Yes.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh.
I don't know if the humans out there know this, but Alton Brown's got the theme from Sherlock on as his ringtone.
And you're the first person to know what it was, which...
1 year ago, almost, not to the day, but a couple weeks, I was at the Emmys last year. Mm-hmm. The Daily Show... Because of my ongoing, very happy affiliation with The Daily Show, they invite me to go with them to the Emmys.
As they should.
And I was invited to the to a party afterward, and I'm sitting at a table with someone I know, and then all of a sudden, sits down a table this size. This is a small table for those of you who can't see. Small marble table.
Small, so yeah. 3.5 feet across. 3 feet.
This is maybe a 4 or 5 top if you stretch, right? Benedict Cumberbatch sits down, and then Martin Freeman sits down. Then Mark Gatiss, the co-creator, and then Stephen Moffat sits down.
Shut up!
I'm not going to shut up.
Oh.
All of it is true. And it's just me and my... So my friend knows all of them, so they came down to talk to her.
Well, then I want to know her.
In the industry. Yeah, you do want to know her.
Yeah, she's the one.
Joe Yao of UTA. Just my talent agent. Boy, oh boy, she's great. But I'm just sitting there going, I don't know what to say. Hi, everyone. And just kind of nerding out. And they were very polite, but they clearly saw that I had nothing to offer the conversation.
Very quickly.
And then
Benedict,
you know,
looked at you and say, you can go now.
You know who you should have come on the show is a really brilliant guy and a very a genius comedian and a really nice guy, Scott Adsit. Who was on 30 Rock. He
30
played
Rock, sure.
Pete on 30 Rock. And if you've never seen him do improv comedy...
Good stuff.
Look, anytime you're in New York, or LA for that matter, because he's working out there a lot too, see what's going on.
Where does he usually play in?
UCB, okay. The Upright Citizens Brigade, either here or there.
Or there, okay.
The most incredible... And I grew up loathing improv comedy from seeing so much bad improv comedy in college. Yeah. But he and John Lutz, also from 30 Rock, do brilliant work. But Adsit is a big Whovian. And so he happened to be at the party. He came over and sat down. And he said, do you know who you're sitting next to? I'm like, yeah, I know. It's
yeah, I know
Moffat.
Who I'm sitting next to.
Yeah, he's like, well, what are you...
The showrunner, Doctor Who.
What are you asking him? Like, what kind of questions are you asking
Can
him?
Can I be
like,
the next doctor? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, nothing. I'm not asking him any questions about Doctor Who. What do you think? I'm some kind of jerk? I'm not going to be the guy who says, oh, now listen, in episode blah, blah, or whatever. And Scott S. is like... and like up until that moment, like I had a few words with Stephen Moffat. I'm sure you don't remember, but I met you a long time ago, and I'm a big fan of the show. Oh, thank you very much. Dead silence. I'm like, all right, I guess that's the end of that, right? Then Scott Adsit pushes me aside and he goes, I wanted to ask you a question about in Silence in the Library, when River Song says that the Doctor is so young, but then the next iteration. Of the Doctor is younger. Stephen Moffat could not be happier than to talk about Doctor Who all night long with Scott Adsit. I felt like I really learned something. Like, people want to talk about the things they make.
It's a great episode, by the way.
It's an amazing episode. Yeah. And he's one of the incredibly, the best television, one of the best television writers I've ever encountered, short of Jane Espenson. But it's just, and Jonathan Ames, of course. But it just, it's just one of those moments, like, don't get over yourself. Like, if you've got a question, ask it.
Ask it.
You know?
They're all just people.
They're all people, and if they made it,
they want to talk.
Chances are they're not tired of talking about it.
Never get tired of talking about something you made unless it went really, really belly up.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for letting me talk about things.
If you ever run into Warren Beatty, don't ask about Ishtar. I'm just saying. I mean, that would be one of those things.
I bet you he'd talk about Ishtar all day long.
He might talk about Ishtar.
That's the thing they want to talk about is the stuff that went wrong. It's just not with microphones.
Not with microphones. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Food fans, that's it for this week. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation with John Hodgman. Interesting fellow, a lot of fun, and I want to thank him for the time that he took to talk with us today. Please stay tuned. Next week, we'll have another fascinating program, which will hopefully have something to do with food. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. That's just the way it is. In the meantime, America, remember, please, cook smart.